This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. This week we're sponsored by MindVault, your personal memorization assistant, which allows you to memorize any passage of text. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on, but you can also find out more at mindvaultapp.com. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's been a great week. How about you?
About the same. Struggling a little bit with the cold, as my voice might suggest, but I'll do my best not to sneeze during the podcast, and if I do, we can always fix that in post, I guess.
We've actually had 6 days of rain here, 6 straight days, and it didn't help that yesterday was the inspection on my home, since we're moving soon, and I'm assuming he did not get up on the roof, that the fact that there was no leaking showed him that the roof was good enough, but we had literally 6 straight days, and we do not normally have that.
But, yeah, it's like my tip for buying a car is always buy a car on a day when it rains, because then you find out if the car leaks.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so,
which in Scotland is, frankly, you can buy it any day of the week as far as I'm concerned, and it'll be raining at some point.
Well, and what's bad here is it's just cold enough to not, or just warm enough to not snow, but just cold enough to be miserable.
Yep.
So, so I guess you have your laptop in hand?
Yes, yes. We mentioned that last show. I think I was in the process of deciding on and then ordering a new laptop. I guess I'd ordered it by the last show, but it hadn't shown up yet. And I have it now. I used to have a 27-inch iMac. And the day before my new laptop appeared, that computer threw its hard drive. It was one of the 27-inch iMacs that was fingered in the Seagate hard drive recall. Terabyte hard drives that had there were a number of production issues with them, and Apple have done a warranty extension for those machines. That's a 2009 machine, so it's out of AppleCare now, but that got dropped off at the Apple store yesterday for a new hard drive. So that was just it's always one of these ways, you know, you buy a new computer and your old computers can almost sense that a new one's on the way, and they start to give you trouble.
Well, and again, the anything 2009 or newer on the iMacs, you really can't use a third-party hard drive since it has that custom temperature sensor on it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, but then your hard drive, your fan and your iMac will just spin up all day long. There are some third-party apps that can slow it down, but, you know, I had mixed feelings about that. I guess it would be nice to be able to use your own hard drive, but I guess obviously Apple has to make decisions, and they probably had a good decision for it. I actually got to work on my first Mac Pro this past week. I had a buddy at his church. They wanted to put an SSD in a 2008 Mac Pro, and that is a really easy machine to work on. There were no screws. You just literally opened up the case, pulled out a drive sled. I slid in the drive adapter along with the SSD, since it's a 2.5-inch SSD, and slid it back in and good to go. So I now see why people like using the Mac Pros, because you could add 4 hard drives within about 5 minutes.
Yeah, they're definitely nice machines to work on. Also easy to drop in additional cards and so on as well. We have one Mac Pro at school that we use for our file server. And we also use it we have an HDMI video capture card in that, which is one of the ways that we can make iPad screencasts. That's a Blackmagic card. There is also a Blackmagic Thunderbolt box now that you would normally use with a more modern Apple laptop, but we didn't have any of them at the time, so we got the add-in card for the Mac Pro, and it's pretty nice. It produces pretty huge files, but you can always wangle them in Final Cut to get them down a little bit.
Yeah, you'd rather have high quality on the front end and compress it later than a terrible quality off the iPad.
And that's why you can put 4 hard drives in a Mac Pro.
That is true. So I don't know that I'd ever want to have one under my desk, but I guess if you needed it, it would be nice. I'd love to, if I had the money in the room, to have that in a closet at my house that kind of stored all of our movies and things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if you look at some of the benchmarks for the newer iMacs, they're starting to get close to Mac Pro numbers. Not for everything. You know, there are some things that Mac Pro still beat them out on, but, you know, for ever-increasing numbers of people, the iMac is the desktop of choice, I guess. And one of my friends just bought the brand new iMac 2 days ago. He's migrating, would you believe, from an eMac G4.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So he's on the phone to me the other night. He was saying, you know, I've got this hard drive that used to back up my eMac, and Migration Assistant's not recognizing it anymore and stuff. And I'm like, I don't know if Migration Assistant is going to handle something quite that old anymore, but I'm going to go down and have a look at it for him.
Yeah, that would be if you could get Migration Assistant to work with an eMac, that would be impressive.
Yeah, we'll maybe follow up in that story next week and see what happens. But he's going to feel like he's in a different world.
Oh, no doubt. Of course, I even think I read that the new Mac Minis are performing as well as like the 2010 Mac Pros, which again is you know, you don't get the storage, but depending on what you need, that, you know, and it does seem like less and less people have a need for a Mac Pro. Not that there's not a need, but it's becoming fewer and far between.
Yeah, it seems to really start to be about additional storage plus additional cards in the machine, and those are the two key areas where Mac Pro still, you know, is way ahead of any other Apple machine.
Yeah, at our church, we have a TV studio, and we're using those Blackmagic cards and things like that, and you really have to have a Mac Pro.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so I wanted to do a little bit of follow-up, Bradley, with a couple of the shows that we did recently. The first one was just from last week. We were talking about projectors and AV systems, and you and I were kind of bemoaning the lack of knowledge and information that we can gather about individual projector units from the web. And one of my friends, Fraser Hess, tweeted to both of us, I think, that one of the ways you can get around that is to build yourself a relationship with an AV company who know the products they're selling and can give you good advice and so on. We have not done that in the past. We've typically just bought off the shelf from Amazon or big box suppliers nearby and so on. I guess the problem for me at the scale that I work at, and probably same for you, Bradley, is that we don't buy enough to be worth people building a relationship with us. That's sometimes, and we certainly don't buy expensive enough equipment either. We tend to buy more basic units rather than pretty sophisticated things. But if you can, and certainly it, as part of a larger lease thing, you know, the company that you do your iPad leasing with or your Mac leasing with, if they can, they also supply that kind of equipment, that may be a good choice as well to get involved with that kind of company.
Well, especially if you, let's say you were building a new wing and you wanted to go in and ceiling mount the projectors and have the nice, I guess, plates on the wall with the connectors, that would be when you'd want to do that. You'd want to call up an AV company, let them basically provide you a solution. Let them, you know, let them pick the projectors, tell them what you're wanting to do and let them find the projector that's the best. So I do like that, you know, basically outsourcing your knowledge. But yeah, we're the same boat. I might buy 3 to 4 projectors a year, if that. And so I just usually go to Amazon and find one that seems to have pretty decent ratings and is a brand I seem to have recognized before.
There are certainly some, I have worked, not personally, but I have been at events where EV companies have managed the event, typically Apple events, but also other organizations as well. And if you find a good AV company to work with, they can make some really nice systems. Some of the Apple events that we do, they have, you know, back projected displays and widescreen and so on. And you can get a really nice effect if you do that. I'm not saying that back-projected displays are typically something you would use in the classroom, obviously, for space reasons, but it feels very kind of empowering to present in front of one if you do have one. Okay, so that was one follow-up. The second one was Gregor McNish, a friend of the show, good guy for feedback. He has sent us some feedback. We were having some discussions a couple of shows back, and in which I said that Dropbox felt like a legacy product. And Gregor partially takes me to task, I think, and fairly. I'm going to just read you part of what he wrote. He said, "You say that Dropbox feels like a legacy product while also seeing the need for inter-app communication and collaboration services in iCloud, which is exactly the service that Dropbox provides, but it does, of course, expose a file system." He continues, "For me, that iPhone and iPad are in large part the front end to Dropbox. I don't use the Dropbox apps itself much, but Dropbox support is critical for me in any app whose data is usefully shareable, between apps on a single device, between multiple devices, or between the device and my Mac, work PC, or Linux cloud server, or between me and other people. Round-tripping in Dropbox is seamless as long as the apps use Dropbox and don't require manual syncing." And I think Gregor makes a really fair point, and certainly it's something that I do myself, is with applications that can sync to Dropbox as part of the back-end storage that they have on the device. My concern with those kind of applications, and Gregor notes that, is that what you're essentially doing is you're building little file systems inside apps themselves. And the one I do this with personally is Readle PDF Expert, which essentially recreates a file system inside the app. And then parts of that file system can sync to Dropbox or other cloud services, which is a great app and it does a great job for me as well. But I just feel like trying to reintroduce the file system to iOS is, you're almost kind of working a little bit across purposes to what the OS is designed to do. And what I would personally like to see is some broader ideas around that, but they have to be implemented at the system level. And I think that was really at the heart of my complaint about Dropbox, was that they're just never going to get the access to the lower file system levels of iOS that that they really need to be as effective as they are on Macs and PCs. And it's great that so many apps do support Dropbox, I think, but also it's just to have Dropbox support as a fundamental requirement for all the apps you use, or most of the apps you use, I can be quite limiting. For example, that means you can't usefully use the iWork applications, except for the possibility of opening and sending a file back to Dropbox from the container on Pages, for example. So that's certainly a fair point from Gregor, and I think it's one that, I don't know about you, Bradley, but I've seen people build some very, very nice workflows with apps that support Dropbox syncing in the background. I guess you and I are kind of a little more Evernote than Dropbox, really, and Evernote does that job for us in large part, but certainly Dropbox is, you know, some people describe it as, you know, the file system for iOS. Lots of apps support it pretty broadly, so it's definitely a good way to go if that's what you need.
I use it for a few things. For me, Dropbox has largely become a sharing mechanism. Most of my stuff just lives in Evernote. I even yesterday moved. I kept disk images from our printer drivers. I kept them in Dropbox. I just added those to Evernote. I don't use them that often. And so really the only things I'm keeping in Dropbox, I keep my day one database as for journaling. And the main reason I do that is they really suggest if as your journal grows larger, especially with photos, that iCloud tends to choke a little bit, which that's obviously a concern. And then I just use it to share files. You know, we share, you know, copies of the show back and forth when we're editing them, and then just to transport files to, you know, friends and whatnot. I use the public folder feature quite a bit, but yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head. Is it doesn't need to be iOS plus Dropbox. It really just needs to be iOS, and your average person will use iCloud because it's built in, but they don't really understand Dropbox. And I always use my in-laws as this example. My father-in-law is a very well-educated man. He's a dentist, so very, very smart. He has an iPhone and an iPad and a Mac, and he has Dropbox on his computer because I put it on there, but he doesn't understand it and doesn't know. You know, he just thinks his data should be there. You know, if he has something on his phone, he thinks it should be on his computer. And so that's just his mindset. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if he has to go then get an iPhone and then install another service/app, and then remember another set of logins, that kind of, I think you've lost a lot of people at that point. And it's just, you know, not only do you need the system level access for a lot of features, but just the simplicity. You know, you sign into an iOS device, you log into your iCloud account, it turns on your mail, it turns on your contacts, turns on your calendar, turns on your app syncing, I guess. And so it just should work. Now, I think one of the ways that Dropbox has really helped itself recently is if you do have the Dropbox iOS app installed and you then go, like, let's say you wanted to use an app like Byword with Dropbox, it used to throw you to a web UI to authenticate. Well, now it throws you to the Dropbox app to authenticate without having to type in your passcode, and then throws you back to the original app, which that's a really big improvement. But I just think 10 years from now, I don't know that Dropbox is as important as it is today. That I think John Siracusa talked about it in one of the final episodes of Hypercritical, that when your company name is your product, I mean, do you really have more? I mean, if iCloud added the features, say, that we wanted, the collaboration and sharing and things like that, Does all your power users even have a need for Dropbox at that point? Again, I got to get a lot of issues with iCloud worked out.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like how if you use an Android device, you're largely going to be using a lot of Google services because they're just built in.
Yeah, I think that's crucial, right? The majority of users. And the thing to bear in mind about iOS, I think, is that it's hard for geeks like us and like Gregor and everybody to kind of move our mind to just understand how mass market iOS really is. You know, it's you're bringing in people who have no conception of really what the cloud is. Now, you know, the iCloud is just a magic thing that happens in the background for them. Now, many of us are coming to iOS from other computer platforms and from other embedded workflows, and it's great that we have Dropbox as a way that we can bridge between these two worlds. But I think what you have is there's iCloud, which is almost invisible, and we discussed that in recent shows, that it's almost invisible, but either not invisible enough or too invisible. But at the same time, the step from going from doing iCloud to doing a Dropbox-based workflow, the additional complexity that you have to adopt there is fine for the highly technical people like us, but for the mass market, I think that's just, it's an incredibly difficult step to get over, because not only have you reintroduced the file system, which is problematic and has been problematic for years, but you also introduce the idea of trying to work around the application sandboxing model on iOS, and that's typically very, very difficult. And we've mentioned before that iCloud doesn't support or doesn't even try to support the kind of sharing things that we want to do. So, you know, you and I have worked in Evernote for the lifetime of this show to do the kind of things that we might otherwise have done with a shared document in the past through Dropbox. And it's these higher levels of abstraction that I think that's where the future really lies, is not exposing the file system, but exposing synchronization and sharing services at some higher level. And I think that's where the mass market and the majority of people find that to be more understandable than just here's a folder that syncs with everybody.
Well, and you could, I mean, if iOS 7 rolls around and they introduce iCloud sharing, and inside of the iWork apps and any apps that want to take advantage of it, you can then share it with an Apple ID or an email address. I mean, that's huge. And that's something they could, you know, all these things we complain about with iCloud are solvable problems. And I think that's the thing to remember. You know, again, I go back to, it needs to just be there. It needs to be built in. And I just don't think that any platform in 2013 and beyond, if it's the platform plus something, is really going to, I guess, is that really as seamless as it needs to be? I mean, look at the new Samsung phones. I think it's the Galaxy S3 or one of the other ones that they have a partnership with Dropbox, where if you log, you know, it comes preloaded with Dropbox. Dropbox is basically the file system for their phone, I believe, and you get a 50 meg account. And that may be a solution for Android-based phones. That may work great, and that may be the route a lot of the power users go to long term. I don't know, mm-hmm. But iCloud, for iOS to be successful for the next 5 years, iCloud needs to get to where we hope it can be, and we hope to see these sharing options, and it needs to come, because that it not being there limits some people. But again, these are all solvable problems that we have. I mean, they'd be working on this right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess what we're advocating for is a little bit like the iMac versus Mac Pro discussion, is that we want the simple, elegant things to become sufficiently powerful that people don't need the incredibly complex thing. You know, if we get, you know, sharing in iCloud and various things, then there will still be people who need a Dropbox-based workflow, absolutely, but those will be fewer and fewer people over time. And I guess that may be the way it goes. Who knows? Time will tell.
Well, I found it interesting. Also, he mentioned O'Reilly books that allows you to sync and update your ebooks directly with Dropbox. And I say that not to mention the Dropbox syncing, which is cool, but I've really become a big fan of O'Reilly here recently. It's O'Reilly Media. For especially this is a place where you can get a lot of technical books because they give you multiple formats. They give you PDF, Mobi, which is for Kindle, and an EPUB, which will work on a lot of devices, including the iPad and the Nook. And they're DRM free. You can just literally download them. And I would love if that's kind of the model everybody went to. It seems so simple. Now, again, their books are a little bit of a premium, but I just like that model. I can buy an EPUB right from them, and it works. I'm always going to have it regardless of what device I have. And I made a comment on Twitter. Maybe Amazon and Apple could offer DRM free copies of their books for maybe a slight premium, maybe a 10% premium. And I got a snarky comment back from a follower that they offer more, with their synchronization. Then so it was, again, it was a snarky comment, but that's neither here nor there. But and so anyways, that's if you're looking for technical books, O'Reilly is a great place to look. Again, I love DRM free.
Yeah, it's interesting with DRM and books and movies, because obviously, we don't have it on music anymore, but books and movies and TV shows are still kind of holding out on us with DRM. And what I've increasingly started thinking is that I don't like DRM in principle, but what I have found is that what I want is I want my media to be inside those synchronization services. So, for example, if you buy an EPUB from O'Reilly, you don't quite get the same smooth experience as you do if you've bought the EPUB from the iBookstore. And the same with the Kindle. If I buy a book from O'Reilly and put it on my Kindle, it doesn't quite work the same way as books I'd bought from Amazon and so on. And the same thing with movies in the cloud now and re-downloadable TV shows and stuff is that I've bought them from iTunes. I can re-download them to any device without having to go back to my Mac and sync them and all that kind of stuff like I would if I bought a DVD and then did things that you're not supposed to do with DVDs that I don't do with DVDs. But other people who are not me definitely do with DVDs. There's now, I'm starting to see more value in the service now. Does that make sense? I mean, you can do with the cloud is powerful and valuable as well.
No, I see your point because when I buy one from O'Reilly, I bought one from directly from my iPad, and I could have opened it in the iBook store and then, synced it back to my Mac. But in the past, when I've done that, it somehow ends up with two copies in there. I'm not really sure. And again, I can't just re-download it right from the iBook store. And so I'm starting, certain books I don't care about. If I buy a book that's $5 on sale or 99 cents on sale, I'm not really concerned about that being DRM free. But certain books I like to just, I guess, feel like I really, really own them. And that may be the same model as some people, for their favorite bands still buy the music CD just to have. And so there may be like certain things you are okay with the DRM, copy, but certain things you want to have the maybe you buy the hardcover and plus the DRM free. I don't know.
I kind of made my peace with book DRM a while ago by thinking that there are so many great books in the world that the chances of me ever going back and rereading one book a second time is I should move on and read something else because there's so much good stuff to read. So continued access to that stuff is maybe not the most important thing. Okay, let's move on to a topic for today. The way we described this topic before the show was the state of the laptop. And obviously this is kind of a little bit inspired by, Bradley, you're thinking about leasing new devices at school. We're obviously thinking about that as well. And obviously recently researching and deciding on a laptop personally was something that kind of brought this whole topic to mind because the laptop world, the Apple laptop world, seems to be in real transition right now. It's kind of a bit of an awkward phase, I think. And I don't know about you and your deliberations, Bradley, but I found it pretty difficult to choose which laptop I was going to get. The only one that it was easy for me to choose not to get was the old-style unibody MacBook Pro with the DVD drive in it because I'm certainly done with DVDs. What are you thinking on the whole topic?
Well, yeah, I really agree with you. My boss and I sat down at lunch yesterday and kind of hammered out our new lease and what computers we're going with. And there really is. I mean, it's like the Retina is great, then that the Airs are great. But then also on the full size, I guess the Pro, you still have the huge hard drives at relatively low cost. So it's kind of there's a lot of options, and I could argue that, you know, either any of them or they're all great. I know that I'll get a new computer out of this lease, and I'm going with the 13-inch Air, and I'm going to upgrade the hard drive to 512 gigabytes, and I'll put 8 gigs of RAM. But obviously, that's a price premium. And I think that's really, once the SSD costs come down, I think the pros just kind of have to die.
Yeah, there's almost a kind of Mac Pro iMac thing again with the unibody MacBook Air has the built-in DVD drive, and it has built-in Ethernet port as well, and it's got the capacity to put a spinning hard drive in, which can be, you know, incredibly cheap per gigabyte compared to any SSD. When I was researching my own laptop purchase, I kind of came to exactly the same conclusion you did. I was coming from having a 27-inch iMac and an 11-inch MacBook Air, and I was looking to go to one computer, and I'm going to sell those other two. So I came to the same conclusion you did, as I went for the 13-inch MacBook Air with all the spec options bumped up. So the 2 gigahertz processor, 8 gigs of RAM, and the 512 gig SSD. And that came to a certain amount of money. I think it might be £1,800 in the UK. And at all levels where the specs were the same for RAM and SSD, the difference between that computer and the 15-inch MacBook Pro with the Retina display was about £400. So that was kind of the premium to go up to that machine. I don't know about you, but I felt that, you know, just reading around the web, I felt that the Retina displays in the laptops were a little immature right now to buy into out of my own personal money rather than out of institutional money, shall we say. There's two things that came to my attention. One was that some people have had an issue with ghosting of the 15-inch Retina display, where, you know, a previous image will kind of be retained on the display after the screen changes. Now, I don't think it's a large number, and I don't think it's typically something that Apple aren't taking care of. I think if you have that problem and you can show it in the store, then you're going to get taken care of. But it just wasn't something I wanted to get into with my personal computer, and specifically because I was going to a model where I only had one computer and not a spare one anywhere. I wanted to get a design that I knew had been built for quite a while and was pretty robust. And the second issue was looking at the 13-inch MacBook Pro with the Retina display. Is that a lot of people, and particularly I picked this up from Anantech.com, but also from other places, that the built-in integrated graphics on the 13-inch MacBook Pro is not really quite powerful enough to drive that Retina display. So there were some complaints on Anantech's review about slow frame rates and animation on the display and so on. And I felt that it was probably better just to wait off that machine and wait for the next generation of Intel chips, which are supposed to bring another graphics improvement, probably up to the point where they'll cope with that display just fine.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you at that. You know, really with that the 15 inches thing is very powerful, but the ghosting issues concern me. And I think this kind of goes back to the old model. Everybody says don't buy the first generation of a big change from Apple. That, you know, generally it's, I think back in maybe 07 that the MacBook Pros had a lot of logic board issues. And again, probably if you buy one, you'll be fine. And we've actually got one here internally that someone has, and it's been fine. But, and I really don't want a 15-inch laptop. I really like a 13-inch laptop. Mm-hmm. And again, I've heard the same thing, that the graphics card is underpowered. So, it is tough because they've kind of got these three different branches of laptop, and it really seems like it needs to be condensed almost back down to one, I would say. And I know we're probably a couple years away from Retina MacBook Airs, but in some ways I'd love to see just an 11, a 13, and a 15-inch MacBook, you know, just straight MacBook, and it be a combination of the Air and the Retina. But that may be a pipe dream.
Yeah, I guess it feels, you know, we know that the Retina displays are currently power hungry in their current technology state. And I guess one of the reasons why Retina displays are not in the MacBook Air is that the wedge shape that we all love with the MacBook Air doesn't offer enough space to keep the battery life that we feel we need, and also put a Retina display and power it for the same length of time. So I guess once there's a kind of power consumption breakthrough on Retina displays, I can see them, you know, it's inevitably the future. This is the thing, is, you know, everything going Retina display is absolutely going to happen. There's no compelling technical reason not to, except that the technology is a little immature. There's no reason why you wouldn't want a Retina display on your screen, except that you're going to have to pay a power cost for it right now. But if we get to the point where Retina displays consume no more power than non-Retina displays, then let's all have a Retina display, right? iPad Mini will have a Retina display, all the MacBook Airs will have a Retina display, and things will be great. But we're just in that awkward phase right now where that's not quite possible. And it's interesting that when they redesigned the MacBook Pro for the Retina displays, they did not make it a tapered design. It's the same height at the front as it is at the back. And I'm guessing that all of that space is just filled with battery.
It is. And it's interesting that the battery, I know on the 15 and I believe on the 13 as well, Retina, the battery is actually, I don't want to say welded. It's actually attached to the top case, which the top case is the, basically everything but the bottom page, you can screw off the bottom tab. And so if you have to replace, the battery for any reason, or let's say you spill something on the keyboard and you have some keys not working, the battery has to be replaced as well. Oddly enough, they require a separate exam to be able to order parts and repair those laptops under warranty. So I find that kind of interesting. Apparently, there's a lot of graphics about protection from fire. Let me just say that. Okay. Before we move on, let's take a quick sponsor break, talk about MindVault. MindVault, back again this week, is your personal memorization assistant. It allows you to memorize any passage of text. So a couple things you could use this for: lines from any play. So if you've got students that are practicing for a play, it's a great thing to get for them. Study for a test, favorite poem or a love song, quotes from someone you admire, debate material, scriptures, wedding vows, really anything. MindVault's looks like to be a great app. I've played around with it quite a bit. Really, really easy to use. Already updated for the iPhone 5. It was also the app of the week on geekwire.com. I saw that come through on app.net this week. So Noah Reed's the developer, great guy. MindVaultApp.com. We'll have a link to his website in the show notes, and the link to the iTunes store. Again, MindVaultApp.com. You focus on the, focus on the words, and you can remember really, really what matters. Even if you're not a teacher, if you're studying for a certification, this is very, very, very helpful. Just a couple of dollars in the App Store. Even if you don't purchase it, let Noah know on Twitter, app.net, that you heard about his ad, and you appreciate him sponsoring the show. Again, mindvaultapp.com.
All right. If you have any important vows to take in the near future, perhaps you've been elected president of the United States or something, that would be a great app to try out.
Well, that's really the great thing about iOS is I had a buddy that was complaining about iCal today, and he wanted to try out VisiCal. He said something about the meeting invites. He likes Fantastic Al, but something about it, he couldn't get the meeting invites working properly with his mail server. And he said, I really want to use VisiCal, but it's $30. And not that $30 is a ton of money, but it's not chump change. Where, if you go out to lunch, you're going to spend $6-7 now. So if you try an app and, if it's $2 or $3 and it ends up being terrible, it's not the end of the world. Again, not that we like wasting money, but it's, if you've got, say, two or three apps, if you're looking for a new weather app and you try two or three of them and you maybe spend $8 overall, but you find one you love, it's $8. It's not the end of the world, especially compared to desktop software.
Yeah. Think how much we used to pay for software, hundreds and hundreds of pounds for apps. And now it's pennies, and people are upset about it.
One of the things I kind of had a note here about was repairability versus integration. Because as we've moved on to the Air style and the Retina style, less and less in the machine is really repairable. Now, with that, you kind of do get an integrated machine, and the hope is that you have fewer things that can go bad. Again, there's no spinning hard disk. The RAM is soldered to the motherboard, so you would think that the RAM would not go bad as easily. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, obviously you guys aren't doing a Mac deployment, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the march of progress. I think, computer car analogies are tired, and I hate making them, but there are few things that people buy in their lives that are as technically complex as both a computer and their car. And I think that the comparison is not totally invalid. And, in cars for years and years, the progression has been towards less maintainable by the user, but in return, much, much, much more reliability. You know, there are cars you can buy in Europe now that you potentially don't service for 3 to 5 years. You know, some of them are, the service intervals are just incredible on some of these cars now. And I think that's kind of the way it's going. And I know with iPads, you don't get there's no repairability at all. You know, you take the thing back and they give you another one, and the repairability or the stripping and the recycling happens, you know, under Apple's care rather than yours. Macs are obviously a little bit different because they're not just going to give you a new MacBook Air for your old MacBook Air and then fix it behind the scenes. They are going to try and take it apart and put in different components and so on. But, you know, you've said this before, Bradley, that, you know, what jobs are you going to do? One, you're going to replace the screen. Two, you're going to replace the top case if you spill stuff on it, and then it's replace the logic board. And there's really three parts you might replace in some of these machines now. So it's not something I'm fundamentally concerned with. I think it's, if the trade-off is right, you know, if you do achieve that substantially higher level of reliability in return for more integration, then I think that's a good trade-off to make. And, you know, I mean, how many years are we into the whole thing about batteries being sealed into laptops and iPhones and so on, and it has not been the end of the world that some people predicted it would be? You know, I mean, even, I was thinking about this the other day, back to the original iMac G3, the Bondi Blue one, people said back then, you shouldn't buy the iMac because if your screen goes bad, you've got to send your whole computer in for repair. And that's, you know, your monitor blowing up is not something we really think about anymore as an everyday occurrence or even a common occurrence. You know, I guess hard drive failure is probably the main thing that people face today. And we're working on that with SSDs as well, that at least mechanical failure is not going to be as big an issue as it has been in the past. So, yeah, I'm broadly in favor of it. And, of course, it enables these much sleeker, slimmer designs that people love as well. And it's, you know, when I think how much weight I used to carry about, I mean, I used to carry a 17-inch PowerBook G4, which weighed about 6.8 pounds. And when I look today at the package of equipment that I carry to go and do, you know, a day's consulting at another school or something, it's just mind-blowing to me how light it is. And I actually did my first consulting event recently where I didn't carry a bag at all. I just took my iPad mini, I took my VGA adapter in my pocket, didn't carry a bag. And that was, at the end of the day, I could actually have gotten that done with even just my iPhone. Because I did a keynote presentation, and I talked to a lot of people, and I could have just pulled up my phone and done it with that. And in the end, they had an Apple TV there, so I didn't even need to bring my adapter. And to go down to this tiny little thing, partly because of all this integration that we can do, I think is great.
I agree that, you know, the repairs are much easier now, that there are really three things to replace. It's just that the repairs are more expensive, and so that's really... Yeah. And it is a gamble. I mean, the biggest thing we've had go bad internally of our deployment has been hard drives and top cases. Top cases have generally been from things being spilled on them. Had one that was thrown up on. That was a lot of fun to work on. Surprisingly, just the top case. If you've ever taken an Apple laptop apart, it seems like they have like a black, almost a tarp film that sits under the keys. So if you do get liquid, it seems to try to hold it there so it doesn't seep down to the logic board. Mm-hmm. So I've actually taken apart a MacBook Air one time. I actually had a one that was 2 weeks old that somebody spilled coffee on. Everything worked fine except some of the keys were squishy. So I literally stripped it down. I mean, down every piece was out and put it back together. And it wasn't too bad. My big complaint on those kind of repairs is it seems like only thing I've seen is the 15-inch aluminum unibody Pros. They will send you a trackpad already installed in the top case. Where everything else, it seems like you have to move the trackpad from the existing machine to the new top case, and they'll send you new screws as well because they don't want you to reuse the existing screws. And it's nearly impossible to get the clickiness back perfect on the trackpad because it's obviously a machine put it together the first time. Yeah. And you can get it where it'll work fine, but it's so hard to adjust those things because you have to adjust them, then put the battery back in, screw it in, then put the case back in. I usually don't screw it in. You just kind of flip it over and so you can test it. And then then rinse and repeat. So you may have 3 hours in testing the clickiness. It's still not perfect. And again, I'm probably not as good at it as others because I've not, you know, if I worked for an Apple store, you probably do that all day long and you really know, but, so yeah, you know, but I think going forward, our next lease is going to have all MacBook Airs. I don't expect a lot of issues. Again, our biggest issue really overall is hard drives, and hopefully that'll be a non-issue.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like the day of the hard drive is coming to a close, you know, and I think it's in a kind of pincer movement between SSDs getting cheaper and also the cloud coming in as well. You know, I've recently been through this because I've obviously migrated from an iMac, 27-inch iMac with a terabyte hard drive that was chock full of stuff, to an external drive and a MacBook Air and so on. And what I found was that with a lot of the cloud stuff, you know, the movies are downloadable from the iTunes store. Using iTunes Match for music means that I don't have to actually carry any of those files on my laptop. I can just stream them or download them from the cloud again. The biggest two chunks that I found were video content that I had not bought from the iTunes store, and also photographs. And I have a pretty large Aperture library with a lot of large files from my DSLR. But Aperture is one of those applications that it probably does the best job of being able to have the library on the internal storage of the machine, but have the large chunks of data off on a separate disk. So that technique is called referenced masters. So the master file from your camera that might be 18 to 25 megabytes can be put off on an external disk, and inside the Aperture library, it will keep a lower resolution JPEG version of the image. So you can browse the library and you can export the preview image to a disk or to email or whatever. But if you want to do some adjustment work on the full res image, you have to reconnect the hard drive, and then Aperture will treat it like the master's present in the library.
Now, how do you back that up? I guess obviously Time Machine doesn't see that, does it?
No, it doesn't, because it's an external disk. I will occasionally clone that disk to another disk, and I also have Backblaze installed. So that's for online backup. Backblaze is a online backup service that will back up all the drives on your machine to their data center in the cloud. And I can tell you that took about a month to complete the initial backup, because I had about 600 gigabytes of raw files. But once I got that done, you know, the incremental changes are perfectly manageable with Backblaze as well.
Yeah, I use CrashPlan. Of course, I've still got my photos. I've probably got 60 gigs of photos still stored on my computer. So I'll kind of have a coming storage problem. Of course, the thing that seems to be keeping the spinning disk around is they keep going up in storage. You know, you can get a 3 terabyte desktop hard drive. So they keep trying to keep themselves relevant, I guess. You know, one of the things I was thinking about too was, you know, if you were doing a Mac deployment today for students and teachers, let's say a MacBook Air, what would your RAM requirements be? Would you do 4 or would you do 8?
That's an interesting question. I don't know for sure. I think my instinct has always been to get as much RAM as possible, and particularly in a world where you can't change after the fact, I would lean towards 8 personally. But I don't think 4 would be catastrophic either. I think that we've been through the 64-bit transition with OS X, so it's not obvious to me that there's something on the horizon that's going to dramatically bloat RAM requirements within the next lease cycle that we're all going to go through. So if 4 works today, I think 4 will work for another 3 years. Whereas, you know, if 8's a struggle for what you want to do, you know, if I was deploying laptops to run Evernote and Safari and so on, and iWork and iLife, 4 gigs would probably be fine. I mean, that was prior to my transition to the 13-inch MacBook Air. My 11-inch actually has kind of become my primary computer. And that was a Core 2 Duo processor, 1.8 gigahertz, I think, 4 gigs of RAM and 128 gig SSD. And that was perfectly suitable for almost everything I needed to do for it. Struggled a bit with Aperture. It was pretty slow to mix down this podcast out of GarageBand, and encoding DVDs was absolute torture. But for most of the productivity tasks and web browsing and email and so on, 4 gigs of RAM was perfectly good.
I think I guess I can run through that real quick, what our next lease looks like. If you guys are interested, we're looking at MacBook Airs for all of our teachers, 13-inch, 128-gigabyte SSD, 8 gigs of RAM upgrade. Students will be, our student laptops will be a 13-inch Air. I believe we're going with the 128-gigabyte and sticking with 4 gigabytes of RAM. Then we will add in another 45 iPads going with the minis. Okay. And so that will supplement, that will be on top of our current 36. And adding in, all of our office staff is going to get a 21-inch iMac. And then my boss and I will both get a 13-inch MacBook Air. So that's kind of our, that's what our next lease looks like. One of the things to remember if you're working on a lease, don't forget to include volume purchase program money. You don't want to buy a lot of iPads and then not have any money to buy apps for them.
Yep. Yep. Definitely. The cost of apps is something that, you know, now that we've got volume purchase in the UK as well, it's something we've been looking at. And I think the way that we're going to handle that for our next lease is that the school is going to volume purchase a certain number of core applications. So we've identified maybe 10 or so applications that we feel everybody should have. And those are things like Keynote and Pages, Explain Everything, GarageBand, iMovie, iPhoto, things like that. The kind of core applications, and also PDF Expert is going to be another one. And then what we're going to do for our secondary kids is we will, because we use iTunes U, we can say that here are the core specific apps that we want people to have. And we're going to, I think, treat that like a kind of classroom resource that we expect parents should supply. So in the same way that we've asked them in the past to supply a calculator for maths or whatever, here's, you know, the three applications you need for computing and the two that you need for art or so on. Because one of the things I've been thinking about is if I was going to custom configure everybody's iPad for the set of courses that they took individually, that's an incredibly expensive coordination problem in terms of time. Because you need to know who's coming back next year, what courses they're taking, and hope they don't change their mind before they come back. So we're going to try and make that as streamlined as we can in terms of what we have to do, and then we're going to hand over a lot of control to the individual students. That's obviously for the older kids. For the younger kids, we're going to try and do some kind of Apple configurator thing, one per classroom or something like that.
Yeah, I think you're looking at the way it's a classroom resource, like a calculator or pencils. It's a great way to look at it. You know, again, we're not talking very expensive as well. Now, one thing that I have not seen so far, and I hope I continue to not see this, is I've not seen a way to take advantage of in-app purchase with the VPP program. So if there's any developers listening, you're wanting to target schools, and you want to build a free version, build a paid version that's a separate app. Don't include it as a volume purchase program upgrade, because we really can't take advantage of that, from what I can tell, within the volume purchase store.
Yeah, I've seen it done a couple of ways with apps. One is my friend James Thompson, who writes the app pCalc, which is a fantastic calculator for iOS. What he's done is he's got a full version that you can just buy, and then he's got a free version that you can in-app purchase various feature sets, all the way up to the point where the free version plus all the in-app purchases is functionally identical to the full version. So there's two routes to buying all the functionality that he's built. One is you just pay and you get it, which is what I've done, and it's what I would do for school. But he's also got the free with in-app purchases. And they're two separate apps, and you can get to the end goal by choosing one or other route. That's a really good way to do it.
Yeah, so we're negotiating with Apple right now and hope to have that new gear in March. So that'll be a busy March for me. It's a fun time, though. It's a really fun time. It's exciting to get all that gear, and then teachers are really excited to get new stuff. The students' equipment probably won't be rolled out until the following fall.
Okay.
But the teachers will talk about, you know, that. Probably talk about that in March, about how we migrate and things like that in that process. Because I've got a lot of training to do as well, because we're still on Snow Leopard on our laptops, and so we're going from Snow Leopard to Mountain Lion. So that's going to be a big change.
Yeah, that's something we're going to have to deal with as well. Just thinking about that, even as I said it, that if we're going to put configurator in the hands of each teacher in the classroom, we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do about that, because all of our iMacs are iMac 4.1s. They're the 2006 iMacs, the first ones that had Intel processors, and they don't even run Lion, let alone Mountain Lion, as far as I know. They're still in Snow Leopard right now. And as far as I remember, Configurator will only run in Lion or later, so we're going to have to figure something out with that. We may have to pick up a couple of Mac Minis or a couple of iMacs or something, just as Apple Configurator stations, if you like, if we're going to make that work. Or maybe we'll just repurpose our old Mac Pro file server for that, because by that point, you know, we certainly won't be running an Open Directory Mac login network anymore, because that's just... there's just not enough demand for that to justify supporting it anymore. And to be honest with you, all of our iMacs, all they do is sync iPads. That's literally all they do in the classroom. Our laptops, yes, we do different things with them, but I think I mentioned this in previous shows that we've actually, the way we deploy our laptops now is we don't have user logins to the laptops. We just use the guest login system for kids to log in, use the web, and then log out again, and that's all we do with them. So the Mac is finding a different role these days. You know, it's, I think Steve Jobs said they were going to be treated like trucks in the future, and we're going to have a couple of trucks kicking about, but most people are going to be riding something a little lighter and a little faster, and that's going to be the iPad.
Well, so we are, so it's a perplexing time with the state of the laptop, that's for sure, and I'm sure over the next 12 to 24 months, that product line will be simplified and kind of shored up. It does feel awkward, though, but it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, I mean, let's not be too down about it. I mean, I think there are great choices everywhere. The Airs are incredible machines. I mean, I'm blown away by the performance of this new MacBook Air, and I'm coming from a unibody MacBook Air before. You know, I had the first generation 11-inch model, and it was a great machine. It was plenty fast at the time, and okay, it got a bit slow, but this thing now is a real speed machine. The Retina displays are fantastic. I mean, immature technology or not, they are just beautiful to look at. And if you look at a 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro and then you crank up the display to more space option, which crunches everything down to very small size, the amount of stuff you can put on that screen is wonderful. So these are great options to have. And I guess I just found it hard because it was something I liked about every single one of them. From the 11-inch MacBook Air, which I love for its size and its lightness and all of that stuff, all the way up to this amazing display on this, you know, really quite slim for the size laptop up there. You know, we're spoiled for choice. We really are. So once we get that power breakthrough in the Retina displays, I think it's going to be, and the price breakthrough in the SSDs, I think we're going to have some really nice machines to choose from.
I agree. So I guess that's all I have. Anything else you have for today?
I just wanted to reflect for 2 minutes on my iPad mini experience, because I had an email exchange with somebody recently where they were asking me, do I still think that the full-size iPad is the right choice for school? And I think when I first got the iPad mini, I wasn't really sure what I thought about it, and I didn't really know where it fitted in, but I think I've kind of clarified my thinking a little bit. And in fact, what I've done is gone back to something I've said in the past about smaller tablets, and what I always wrote and said about the Google Nexus 7 and various tablets like that was that a 7-inch tablet makes a great adjunct to a computer, and a 10-inch tablet can replace a computer. And I think, you know, having spent a lot of time with the iPad mini now, I really feel that that is really right. I think that's right on the money, because what I'm finding now with the way I work with the iPad mini and the MacBook Air is that I'm bouncing between the two devices much more than I did when I had the full-size iPad. You know, with full-size iPad, I could go a whole day without touching the laptop. But what I find now is that I kind of move between them much more seamlessly. And it's interesting because what has happened in software, and this goes back to the discussion at the very start of the show, what's happened in software since the time of the first iPad is that integration between OS X and iOS has become much greater. You know, we've got iCloud, Dropbox is a better workflow than it was, and we've got things like Evernote as well, and many services like that. You know, Google Docs is getting better on iOS, and it's much, much easier now than it was before to do that kind of workflow where you seamlessly move between a desktop machine and an iPad, whereas previously we would kind of go all in with iPad. So the conclusion I came to in that email was, I said, if I could afford to do a 2-to-1 deployment and give everybody a laptop and an iPad, it would unquestionably be an 11-inch MacBook Air or a 13-inch MacBook Air and an iPad mini. That would be absolutely the iPad I would choose. But because I can't do that, and people don't want to give up the iPad, I'm going to give them the biggest iPad I can give them, and that's going to have to take all the weight of what it is they want to do. So it's interesting just to kind of think that through again and realize how the world has changed a little bit, how services are starting to mature and increased reliability and increased performance as well, and how that's enabling just different ways of working with these devices.
Yeah, it's kind of back to that whole desktop versus laptop discussion of maybe 7-8 years ago. And, you know, what's the best thing for it? And these are all great problems to have. But I tend to agree with you that an ideal situation is an iPad plus a laptop.
Yeah, and these things come in cycles as well. You know, there was a period where having a laptop only was a perfectly sensible choice, and then desktops got so powerful and cheap that, you know, our heads were turned back to getting an iMac, and then now we're looking at laptops again. And, you know, in some ways, the laptop's the new desktop, and the iPad's the new laptop, and so on. It's great times. I think I'm really excited about the way technology is going right now.
Yeah, I think you're right about the laptop as the new desktop. So, for example, like if my house was destroyed and I had to buy all new technology for my home, we would probably get one laptop and then two iPads.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we are in the house now. We've got my MacBook Air. My wife's got an old 21-inch iMac, which we basically use as a kind of integrated Apple TV for the kids in the playroom. And then we've both got our iPads.
What do you use at work?
I use this MacBook Air for everything.
Okay.
So that's the one machine that rules them all.
Well, yeah, I like that too. I don't like having multiple machines. Even with all syncing, I just like having one machine. But I've found that even, you know, as months have gone by, I take my laptop home less and less, especially during the week. I just take my iPad with me, and then if I need to do something at night, I can do it from my iPad. But it's also partly to keep me from working at night and spend more time. You know, obviously, I wouldn't be able to do it with my son awake, but once he goes to bed, it keeps me from working and just relax and spend time with my wife. So I just leave it at work and bring it home on the weekends, mainly to back it up. But I'm just really trying to get better about in some ways, create a better division between work and home, where when I'm at work, I focus on work, and when I go home, it's time to be home, because just the emails all weekend long, it just will drain you after a while.
Yeah, it can follow you around, can't it?
I guess we'll be back next week. Again, thanks for Mind Vault for sponsoring the show this week, mindvaultapp.com, and hope everybody has a great week.
Okay, if you want to rate the show on iTunes, that would be really helpful. I saw a few people did that over Christmas, and we really appreciate that. It's always nice to just click into the podcast application and see people saying some nice things about the show, and that also helps other people discover the show. So if you have a couple of minutes, we'd really appreciate a review and a star rating on iTunes.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Okay.